History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, it just so happens that we're educated, we're entertained, and really we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The 99-year-old you're going to hear from today, Ralph Graham, lives in Waco, Texas. Just within the last year, he has published a book called 12 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Ghost Plane at the Battle of the Bulge. You're going to hear about why the book carries that title, but this interview was not recorded in the Lone Star State. In Atwater, California, rather, at Castle Air Museum, home to dozens of historic aircraft like the B-17 Flying Fortress, the kind of bomber Ralph flew 33 missions in during World War II. But Ralph Graham has a deeper connection to Castle Air Museum. His connection is to the mission that earned the museum's namesake, our nation's highest military honor. And to put that in perspective for us, we're going to hear first from the executive director of Castle Air Museum, Joe Pruzzo. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can see this 99-year-old Army Air Corps veteran, Ralph Graham, hitting the opening tee shot for Castle Air Museum's annual golf tournament. Ralph and his family foursome fared very well in that tournament, but the history he represents tells a much bigger story. So let's allow Joe Pruzzo to shed some light on that before we hear from Mr. Graham.
Well, first off, it was a great honor and privilege to meet someone from the greatest generation that took part in the battle high above the skies of the Battle of the Bulge, certainly one of the most significant engagements of World War II. What's even more impressive is his connection to the museum's namesake, the former Air Force base's namesake, General Frederick Walker Castle, and knowing that he was in a formation of 2,000 B-17 Flying Fortresses that were being commanded by General Castle is really a significant, to us, a milestone. Talk about coming full circle. Many of your listeners may or may not know General Castle on that mission was flying a brand new airplane in the lead position. He had an engine failure. He had to drop to the back of the formation. And when he did that, he became an easy prey for Luftwaffe fighters. And he ultimately, rather than drop bombs over friendly troops, he and his pilot ultimately gave the supreme sacrifice and let the crew bail out before General Castle and his pilot could bail out. The airplane exploded. And we actually have parts of that airplane here in our museum that we exhibit in the indoor exhibit, along with his memorabilia and uniform and Medal of Honor. You and I, being historians, have realized this, but many people out there don't realize that these were 18, 19, 20-year-old men and right out of high school. And that's a pretty tough way to grow up.
No doubt. And, you know, with regard to General Castle, there are a lot of people that were stationed at Castle Air Force Base when it was an active base. There are a lot of people who have come through the museum who see that name, and they really may not know the history behind the name. How important is that to you in preserving this history, in moving the museum forward, to hang on to that history and to tell the story of General Castle and the others like him?
Well, it's our mission and ultimately goal to teach and educate people coming through the museum on the importance of General Castle and his sacrifices and men like him and those who served under him, and how important their position in history is in preserving the free will of our nation, our freedoms, and those of our allies. And I would say there were thousands of people that served at Merced Army Airfield when it was first here, and then it was changed to Castle Air Force Base, I believe, in late 1946 in honor of the General Castle. There are many that flew those harrowing missions, and not only in the European theater, but in the Pacific theater and all over the world. We have to remember World War II was, you know, when we talk about wars today, okay, the war on terror in Afghanistan is pretty geographically isolated or a certain geographic area of the world, but World War II encompassed the whole globe. And that in itself is when you put it into context, is mind-boggling. So the sacrifices made, yes. Unfortunately, these are the things that aren't taught in history classes in school today. So it's up to museums like Castle Air Museum to teach young people and the people coming through on their sacrifices and the importance of air power.
And so you got to see Ralph Graham's golf swing. He hit the first tee shot for your golf tournament, and he also had his book. You have any of those books left?
Yes. We have a couple. We're going to be reordering some. It's called 12 Minutes. And what that signifies is Ralph Graham's airplane was also a new airplane, but they had a mechanical failure. So they went and got a broken in or war weary B-17. And in order to transfer gear and equipment, it took 12 minutes. So they were 12 minutes late in catching up with the formation. So that 12 minutes was pretty critical in the scheme of things. They actually bombed with another squadron that they weren't attached to, but ordered by General Castle to join up with any squadron they could. And if you can get it on Amazon as well, but if you get a chance, get it and read it, because it's a very gripping story. And it's something, and when I first picked it up, I couldn't put it down. I wanted to read more. And to have someone that within memory, not in a history book, was there on that particular day in that mission, Christmas Eve 1944, I'm in awe at. You know, I didn't read about this. I actually talked to a living person who was there.
And I just bring up the book, wondering if people hear this program and want to get the book. Yeah, they can order it on Amazon. But if they come up to check out a few planes at, or a few dozen planes at Castle Air Museum, they might find it in the gift shop too.
We may have a couple copies left. We definitely sold out, and we're going to have to order more. So we will try and get some expeditiously. But it is a certain treat, and it's really add it to your library, because it's a real great historical treasure written from a personal account.
And anything else about Ralph specifically that made an impression on you?
Oh, a lot of things. You know, God bless him. He was able to shoot a 7-under par at 99 years old. He doesn't look a day over 80, Paul. I wonder what his secret is. You know, maybe it's that golf swing. I don't know, but his mental capacities, as sharp as a tack, and just a wonderful, warm gentleman. And that so typified that generation, the Greatest Generation. And unfortunately, there aren't a lot of them around anymore to pass on those stories. And you know, the lessons learned, the lessons of World War II and the lessons of any conflict should never be forgotten. Because if they are, some point when generations forget, we'll repeat them. And we can't, we shouldn't allow ourselves to do that.
Which is exactly why this program exists. And with that, let's welcome in 99-year-old Ralph Graham of Waco, Texas, originally from Athens, Texas. Where is that, Ralph, for those of us who don't know? And what do you remember about your childhood there?
Athens is about 75 miles southeast of Dallas. And what I remember more about my childhood was what we lived on a farm. My father raised cotton and corn and, you know, and everything you could think about. And he taught me to how to plow. And I remember when I was 9 years old, and he finally turned it over to me with plow and by myself with a Georgia stock and one horse pulling it. And I he'd let me plow out the meadows, you know, and all of that. And it went on from that until I grew up, and then I got to hating it.
It's exciting for a while. Right.
But we did a lot of work, and he was a wonderful farmer. He grew everything. He, you know, we'd have everything. During the Depression, we had everything he'd raised. We even had a peach orchard. And I remember during all those hard times that people would come there to get milk, and peaches and potatoes and Irish potatoes and canned meat. And what he just give it, we had so much of it, and he didn't want people to suffer, so he would just give it away.
Wow.
And that was our neighbors, you know, had nothing but a house to live in. It's pretty rough times, you know. And, of course, I remember starting to school, and I remember we had sometimes had to walk 2 miles or three to get to school. That before we had buses, you know, to pick us up. That was as I grew up in the, you know, ready for high school,
mm-hmm.
So 5, 6, 7 years. And finally, I went, I graduated as a ninth grader, you know, and they sent me on to high school. And we only had 3 grades then. It had 9th, 10th, and 11th. That was it. You didn't go to the 12th. I remember all that, and then all the associates, you know, and my classmates.
Do you remember as a boy having some ambition of, hey, when I grow up someday, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Well, I knew I wanted to do something, but I didn't. You know, at that time, you didn't. You know, there wasn't much. There wasn't much future to look to because it was hard. It was bad, you know, during the Depression. But I did want to. I really wanted to be an engineer. When we enlisted, they asked you what you wanted to do, and I told them, you know, I'd like to be in that part where we built bridges and things like that. And that's where they put me, and that's where I served for about 16 months, all my time there. From that, there was a bulletin came out that said, if you'd like to try out as an aviation cadet, you can go down and take the test. And I did, and I barely passed. But anyway, a classmate and mine went down and we tried, and both of us did. And I went on through. I don't want to get into that too much if you don't think so about the training.
Whatever you think is relevant, but okay. I am interested on the timing. So when you went from the regular Army to the aviation program, was that before or after Pearl Harbor?
That was after. That's the reason they sent this bit, the bulletin out, because they needed our, you know, if it could pass.
Right. So tell me about, though, December 7th. Where were you, and how did you find out what happened?
December 7th, I was, of course, still in the engineers, and we was walking down the street, been down to the recreation room, and we got back up to the door where you go in the barracks, and somebody hollered out, says, the Japanese has hit Pearl Harbor. Well, I didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was, you know. I hadn't been in the Army, you know, that long enough to know that. But anyway, that was my first time I knew that it was in war.
And where was that? Where were you?
That was in San Antonio, with the 2nd Infantry Division, and the 2nd Engineers was part of it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's where I was. We came up from boot camp up to it.
And did you see things changing a lot after Pearl Harbor?
Oh, you bet. I think we were about 350,000 people in the services then, and we watched it grow and just tumble. It's just thousands after thousands that came in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason they wanted to pick out somebody that had, I did have a high school education, you know, had to do that to qualify to train. Well, anyway, I trained for, went through primary and then basic.
You're thinking you're going to be a pilot.
I yeah, I learned to fly. Mm-hmm. But something happened. It really happened in primary. I felt something, you know, in doing aerobatics like spins and loops and all that, where the strain was on you. I felt pressure in my lower part of my body. Well, I made it all right in that plane, but when I went to basic, well, when we went from 165 horsepower to 450.
Was that from a Stearman to a BT-13 or something?
That's what it was. Yeah. The old Vultee vibrator, they called it.
So it's a big difference in power.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that showed up bad. So I went to the doctor and told him I was having trouble. He said, well, the only thing he could do was operate. So I went back and I tried again, you know, to see if I could make it through. And I blacked out. And I went on back and told him, let's operate. I wanted to finish so bad. I said, go ahead and operate. And he did, but it didn't help. You can't fly a plane with that, you know. So I told him I didn't want to go on paperwork until that cured out. I wanted to go on. So they sent me on to radio school.
How disappointing was that for you at the time?
It was bad, because I wanted to be an officer, you know.
Yeah.
But that was all right. You know, I didn't want somebody to give me something. So I went on to radio school and finished that. And then the gunnery school, finished that. And they put a cruiser up. We went through, you know, the basic part of a team working together. Of course, from there, and it was up through the northern part. We flew over and carried bomb bay full of GI mail. We left one night about sundown and got about halfway, and they turned us back on account of the weather closed in Iceland. So we came back and waited a few days longer, and it cleared up, and this time we made it. Bunch of kids.
I was going to say, was that a little nerve-wracking for you? You'd never been through anything like that before.
Flying across, you know, 1,500 miles of water. Well, the pilot did kind of, he became a little worried every once in a while. He said, call the navigator and say, how we doing? Well, we're on course. That's about all he knew. And I did. I called him once and told him the radio traffic was sounding louder, you know, and he said, that's some relief. And so, of course, we finally, navigator was right. We went right on money. That was really the last part of the war, because we didn't go over until October of 1944. And all this stuff that I wrote about the book, that happened Christmas Eve of 1944. So, but we still training all times. Some of the crews have been there and did that. They helped us out, you know, and what we should look forward to, you know, prepared us for the mission, you know.
Were you a little anxious before your first mission?
You know, I wasn't. We went to Ham. Ham, Germany, that was the shortest mission over there, and I guess they did that on purpose. But, of course, we didn't have enough sense to be scared, you know. But we finally picked it up, you know, that it was dangerous.
Well, I'm always curious, too, because, you know, you've been looking at it in hindsight for most of your life now.
Right.
But before that, I mean, even before you're going overseas, some guys have told me, you know, I was invincible. Nothing was ever going to happen. Other guys have said, hey, I knew it could be me at any moment. Did it weigh on you at all, the possibility that you could be killed over there?
Well, sure, everybody has fright. But one of the things that helped us most was those 16 months that I spent in the regular Army. Mm-hmm. When we were trained, like they made men out of boys, so to speak, you know. We'd go on marches and march all night long and then rest, and several times the rain would be pouring down. And we'd lay down on the ground, and the rain wouldn't even bother us. We'd sleep 30, 40 minutes, and up going again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. And then went to Louisiana for maneuvers, and it's the same old story. You lay there in a pup tent, and it rained that night, and you'd have water marks on your legs. But, you know, things like that toughens you up, and you learn to give and take, you know, and say, well, this is going to happen. Yeah, I better do this. So It really did help, because I could tell some of the younger people that didn't do, they went directly into the Air Force.
So it sounds like you're saying that time in the Army helped you understand that you could handle and endure more than you maybe thought.
You were still frightened, scared, of course, especially on different situations. But overall, it really helped. It sure did.
And I guess another, you know, thought that comes to mind, if you hadn't volunteered for aviation cadet training, you might have been one of those guys on the ground at the Battle of the Bulge.
Incidentally, they were. the second engineers is one that the Germans was running over. That was the fog was so heavy that even they didn't know what they were hitting.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guys said that we lost some of the people that I soldiered with. The tanks would run over them. Because, like I say, the Germans couldn't. It was a mess, you know. The book will tell about that, but that's actually what it was.
So you don't have to speculate or wonder. You know where your unit was and what happened to it.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Ralph Graham of Waco, Texas, including details from that Christmas Eve mission in 1944. While those beleaguered troops on the ground in the Battle of the Bulge finally had air support, there were airmen who gave their lives for our country that day, including General Frederick Castle. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with today's guest, Ralph Graham, as well as a link to his book, 12 Minutes. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.